Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1 with Miriam O'Callaghan.
My guests this morning are a father and his eldest daughter. Sarah Carey is a journalist who writes for the Irish Catholic and broadcasts on News Talk Radio. She is married to Michael and they have three sons. Her father, Bill, has been in local politics for more than 45 years. He's a Fine Gael County Councillor and is Vice President of the Congress of Europe in Strasbourg. He's married to Betty and they've got five children. Sarah is their third child. Both Sarah and Bill live in Enfield in County Meath. You're both very welcome.
Good morning, Miriam.
So, Bill, has Enfield changed much over the years?
Well, when I was elected first, it was a one-horse village of 200 people. And today the population of the village is 2,500. So that's a dramatic change.
Are people as friendly? Is it as kind of neighbourly as it would have been maybe when you were young?
No. At that time, you knew everybody, and when you walked up the street, even though it was small, everybody knew you and everybody said hello, goodbye, and so on and so forth. Now, with so many strangers in it, people don't look at you. They all look straight ahead, and it's very hard to communicate with them or get them to feel that here's one of our own, you know.
Yeah.
There's still that divide there. So I suppose they've moved into a new area. They've got young families. They probably all have mortgages. They have worries and concerns, you know. And they would never think that by saying hello to the natives that they could share maybe their worries with them, you know.
Yeah.
Some way or other. That's a big change. And it's a change that has taken place all over South Meath.
What I think I've noticed more is the generational contact that people had. So I grew up on a road where you knew people's grandfathers and maybe even great-grandfathers. And because services were so much fewer and people didn't have cars, and I think we were nearly the only people on the road with a phone at one stage, there was massive interdependence. You really relied on your neighbours. And for example, somebody like my mother that used to be a nurse would be somebody that would be called upon in emergencies. So she might have delivered a baby on our road in the middle of the night. If someone died, she would have laid out the dead. Things like that. And that's what I think is gone. That families needing each other and performing those services for each other. Now it's, you might not know somebody's parents because they've moved newly in, and if they die, they die in hospital. It's, and you know, there isn't that connection between the families. That's the big change that I notice.
Your family, though, has a connection going back a really long time. Your great-grandfather, was he from Kilbeggan?
He was from Kilbeggan and trained as a doctor in the Royal College of Surgeons, and then went to England where he practiced and came back to Ireland, a wealthy man, and bought a farm near Enfield. When would that have been? 1920s.
Yeah. Mid-20s.
Yeah, so he, and so that was the real first foothold in Enfield when he bought that farm. And he had just one son, Bill's father, Kevin. And his wife, my father's mother, was a great woman. She was fascinating. She came from a big Dublin family. Her father was a horse dealer and bred horses that were sold for running the tram lines and the armies and things like that. And her father was a great man because he made sure all his daughters were educated properly. They were all sent to England. They all had degrees. My grandaunt was one of the first women in Trinity College, and she got a gold medal in Spanish. My grandmother was trained as a piano teacher, and all her life she kept the family going teaching piano. So I often think, though they would never have called themselves feminists, they were feminists because they could all keep themselves when the crunch came, didn't they?
They did, yeah.
And that was always, I think, expected of us. And my mother's mother would have been a very independent, strong person as well. So I always think, even though that label was never put on us, we were always taught, be independent, be able to look after yourself. And that was a very strong influence.
Right, from
on
a
us.
Long line of feminists,
yeah, a long line of feminists, yes. Yeah.
And then your family circumstances, did they change a bit then, Bill?
Oh, they did. The economic war, shall we say, to put it bluntly, practically broke my grandfather, you know, and my father. The farm was heavily stocked with expensive cattle at the time, and then when the economic war came, the cattle were worthless. They lost all their money, as did several other people. And finish up was they started to downsize. The Second World War started, and he branched into agricultural contracting. And then when the war ended, the need for compulsory tillage, there was no need for that anymore, so there was less work for agriculture and contractors. And then disaster struck his dairy herd, and he was hit with brucellosis in about 1947, and there was no cure for that at the time, as there is now. So it was downhill then for a few years, you know. Unfortunately, it was one of those things.
When you look back and, I suppose, hear the family history about the economic war, Sarah, is that that created the affinity with Fine Gael in your family, do you think?
I don't know, but one thing I do always know is that I would have heard very little about the impact of the economic war in school. I never would have known much about how it really affected rural people and farmers had I not heard about it at home. So I got the fireside history of it. And I know, for instance, my mother would say in Cavan, they were throwing calves into Loch Sheelan because there was no point rearing them because there was no market. And it was just astonishing the way, and I think this was the impact, a political policy could destroy people. I mean, just to remind people, it was when De Valera decided that Ireland would no longer pay the land annuities to England. And then in response, England wouldn't trade with Ireland. And it was madness, I
madness.
Think. Yeah. And I would never have learned about the impact of that on families were it not for my own history. And I think there's a big social history of Ireland that's largely forgotten about and isn't taught. And I have a history degree, but that history of Ireland is forgotten about, almost written out nearly.
But it is your family almost is a representation of it, a reminder.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. And
so did your family love Eamon De Valera? I say with irony, Bill.
We won't elaborate. Yeah.
Where did the Fine Gael element come in your family?
Well, all I can remember as a child was my mother always voted for Captain Paddy Giles, who was the Fine Gael TD at the time. My father would probably have voted for him as well. And then in 46 or 47, when Clan na Publicta was formed, my father fell for it big time. He fell for Sean McBride and those idealists, you know. I joined the local branch of Fine Gael. It could be at that time because I was friendly with other people who did. And then there was a change in the constituency, and I was brought to a meeting in Enfield one night, Fine Gael meeting, and it was being addressed by the new TD for the area from Kildare, the late Gerard Sweetman. And he left an impression on me that I have to this day. He was an outstanding man. And a funny thing, I see there's a seminar about him in Maynooth College in a couple of weeks' time. And it says he was Minister for Finance from 54 to 57. And it was he who brought T.K. Whittaker into the Department of Finance. And between them, they laid the foundation for the first programme for economic expansion, which Sean Lamass got all the credit for. And now, thanks be to God, T.K. Whittaker is still there to see it. But Gerard Sweetman, unfortunately, was killed in 1970. He was one of the biggest losses the country ever suffered, you know, because he had foresight, he had brains, he was a statesman. I remember Dillon speaking at a constituency meeting in Kildare, and he described Gerard Sweetman as the one you would take tiger hunting to mind your back. And he felt that was the greatest.
We could do with them now by the sound of things.
It was the greatest tribute you could pay to anybody, you know.
Were you aware growing up Sarah, of what families were Fianna Fáil and what families were Fine Gael.
Don't talk to me, Miriam. If I came home from school and mentioned some new friend that I wanted to play with, Fianna Fáil, or worse, mentioned another name, Black Fianna Fáil, I remember saying, Daddy, yes, you know the way you say if someone's really Fianna Fáil, that they're Black Fianna Fáil? Yes. Well, you know the way we're really Fine Gael? Yes. Well, would they call us Black Fine Gael? There's no such thing. So that was, everyone was identified by who they voted
for. What's the difference between Fianna Fáil then, Bill, and Black Fianna Fáil?
Oh, I would be friendly with thousands of people, Fianna Fáil people.
They'd be some only of our best friends.
Some
Miriam.
Of my best friends would be Fianna Fáil people. And only for Fianna Fáil people, I would never have got elected. That's how I always get elected, because I get cross-party votes, particularly from Fianna Fáil. I respect them and they know that. And they can come to me with their problems and they know it won't go any further. But then there would be a Fianna Fáil cohort who would not come to me, irrespective of if they were going straight to the grave.
And they're the Black Fianna Fáil.
They're the Black ones. Yeah. Yeah. And then there's a family in a rural part of my area who needed something done with a graveyard. And they weren't making much progress through the Fianna Fáil organisation. And for some reason or other, they got in touch with me. And I felt kind of sorry for them. And I was seen going into a meeting they had one night by a Fine Gael family who lived across the road. And I went in anyway. We discussed the graveyard problems. The next day I got a phone call from the Fine Gael house. We saw you going into the Fianna Fáil meeting last night. But to make a long story short, we achieved what we set out to achieve with the graveyard. And I get a mass bouquet card from them every Christmas, and coming up to the election, I'd call to the house, we can't vote for you, but we're praying that you'll get in. And the mass card comes, and I always got in.
So the prayer worked.
Yeah,
it's something. Yeah. Would you go into politics? I know you haven't yet, but would you consider
it? You know, you should never say never, but having grown up in a political household and seeing the impact that it does have and the energy that you need, Daddy's one of these people that politics energises him. So he would come home from day's work, wolf down the dinner, gone. Meetings, removals, canvassing, whatever it is. By the time it gets to 6 or 7 in the evening, I'm wrecked. I'm just thinking of get the kids to bed and you know, watch useless TV. So I don't know where he gets the stamina for it.
So he has a wife?
Yeah, he does have a wife, and that's important. But the other thing is that I don't think I'd have the thick skin that you need for it. And I remember one time during the early 80s, do you remember the three elections?
Yeah.
And I always remember during one of those elections, I don't know which one it was, John Bruton coming into the house, having been out canvassing. And I can still see him sitting in a chair in the kitchen, and my mother was over at the cooker, maybe making a bit of supper for him. He was exhausted. The greyness of his face and the tiredness, and he hadn't shaved, and Fianna Fáil were probably going to win, and they were getting nothing but abuse. And at the time, the stakes seemed so high, like democracy itself seemed to be under threat. You know, it was the whole goo-boo time and phones being tapped and all of that. And seeing him actually made a huge impact on me. This is what it does to strong men. How would I be able to withstand that?
Would you like Kurt to have gone into politics, Bill?
Yes and no. Yes, I think she'd be absolutely brilliant. And the country needs someone like her.
Mm-hmm. More women?
No, not necessarily. We argue strong on that one, and I do with my colleagues on the county council. It's a battle that we always have, because I don't approve of feminism, but I approve of people and their ability to do it. And Sarah, I wouldn't care. It's like the story that the New York politician told about feminism. He wouldn't care whether the fireman that came up to the top of the skyscraper to take him out on the ladder wore a bra or Y front as long as he got him down to the ground. Well, I'm the same.
Well, that is feminism, actually. I think you mean you don't approve of gender quotas and affirmative action, maybe.
No, I don't care what a person is, male or female, if they're able to do the job.
Okay, yeah.
That's what I'm trying to get across. And I believe Sarah is well able to do the job, as, and I won't say as good as any man. She's a top. She would be a top class
The language
person.
Is always so difficult.
But the physical stamina, I think, is too cruel. Or it's gruesome, you know, and I'd be afraid she wouldn't.
Especially if you have young children.
Yeah, definitely. I think as long as women are the primary carers, to try to match children and politics is almost impossible. But my attitude to that had always been, you know, this, oh, can you have it all argument? You can have it all. Not at the same time. Yeah. So I've parked that whole thing in my head. And the most important thing now is get my children sorted, rear them, spend time with them. And there'll come a time when I won't see them for dust. And I'll be sitting at home then figuring out what to do with myself. Mm. And maybe then reassess, is there, you know, maybe then I might do it.
Credit your husband, Michael, though. He's outside there holding your baby.
Yes, he is. And he is brilliant. And, you know, and they do always say there's, you know, all these politicians and these men going out doing things, you know, that they all have great wives at home, keeping the home fires burning. So he is brilliant at all that stuff and with the kids. So he's great. So I would need his full support. So far, he has completely vetoed any notion of going into politics and
we'll
says no way
it.
You'd be crazy. Yeah, so I'd have to get permission, the permission slip there first.
Now listen, the first piece of music we're going to take is one that you love, Sarah, the Battle Hymn of the Republic, that reminds you
of
your
childhood. The Battle Hymn of the Republic is, it's a real family anthem. As I said earlier, my granny was a piano teacher and of course would always play at family parties, and daddy always played the piano too, and he would play in bars and hotels and things like that when he was growing up. And for some completely inappropriate reason, I was taught this song in school. It's a battle hymn. I don't know why. So of course at family parties they'd play and I'd be there, 8 or 9 years old, all the words, all the verses, and everybody joining in, glory, glory, hallelujah. And we played it then at granny's funeral when the coffin was leaving the church. And I just thought it really summed up our family spirit, that instead of the sadder songs, this was facing, marching strongly, looking death in the eye, and a rousing hymn. So it's kind of our song.
Battle Hymn of the Republic there, a song you love.
I'm just laughing at Miriam listening to it because I associate that so much with granny and daddy and playing the piano. And just last week, my husband Michael and Uncle Jim moved granny's piano into our house so I could get my kids to start learning how to play the piano. And Michael is kind of famous in our family for having a cautious approach to life and being conscious of health and safety. And Uncle Jimmy was trying to persuade him to get into the trailer to hold the piano so it wouldn't fall out while they were driving down the road with the piano. I was saying, but if the piano goes to slide out of the trailer, you're not going to be able to stop it. And daddy had famously said that lad will die in a freak accident. I thought he'll end up being crushed by granny's piano. So now when I hear that song, this is what I think of.
You never stood for, or did you stand for national politics?
Oh, I did.
Okay.
Yes, 1969. We were back into Mead constituency, and the figures were totally against us, and Sweetman decided the best hope was to run this young fella from South Mead along with Dennis Farrelly, the experienced man, and we'd be a good team. And when it came to the convention, somebody, there was a movement on by the people over in Eastmead that they wanted a candidate, and much to everyone's amazement or disgust, depending on your point of view, Bruton was the third candidate. So John started out the next day on a box outside Chapel Gates and all that, months before the election, and myself and Dennis Farrelly sat back, no, we're, that's not playing the game, you know, blah, blah, blah. But the rest of it is history. Yeah. We stayed back, and Bruton created an impression, and we had the IFA or the NFA, as they were behind him at the time, and he got elected.
But Mammy always said she was so relieved that Daddy did not go into national politics, because as busy as the House was with the coming and going over the council, that national politics would have broken us completely. So she always thought it was the greatest stroke of luck that he did not get into national politics.
And if I could say, after that election, I was thinking about a Senate nomination, and I remember we met the late Paddy Belt, and now you wouldn't remember him, but he
was... I know of him, yeah.
You would know of him, like, yeah. He was a great man. He asked me, what did I do for a living? And I told him I had a small auctioneer's... I had an auctioneer's licence and I had a herd of cows. And he said, well, do you know, do you want a bit of advice, young fella? Well, I do. He said, go home and look after your cows. Mm. And I thought for a minute and I said, he's right, I'm getting the hell out of here. And I never went back. And I never looked back.
Interesting. And have you always liked local politics? Like, you're on the... How long are you on the county council? How many years?
47. I think 47, 67, whatever it is.
A few years then you're on that county council.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it of any use, local politics?
Look, it's madness. In real terms, it's madness. But it's just, you get bitten by the bug. And I was saying yesterday, if I had any sense, I would probably have got out after 10 or 15 years. But at this stage, I had been bitten. I liked it. But I'm convinced that if I spent more time at home minding my business and my cows, as Paddy Belton said, I'd be a wealthy man today.
But you mightn't be as happy.
Probably not. No, probably not.
When you were growing up, Sarah, Betty, obviously, as the mum, was she very much the dominant force in the house because your dad had
Well, there's, I think, a Jim Carrey line that says, behind every great man is a woman rolling her eyes. And that was very much Mammy. And I think as well, when you're on a farm, there's an awful lot of work to be done. And then they had their own business. They had the auctioneering, they had a gift shop. So there was a huge amount of work to be done. So somebody had to be the rock at home. But she's great. She's a really, really practical person, and has, of course, had a huge influence on me. And I always think my relationship with her was best manifested itself in how I gave birth to my children and her voice being in my head. And I remember being in labour with the first one and Michael driving into Hollis Street, and I was getting these desperate labour pains and this vision of her and I sitting on the couch watching some American show and some woman screaming her head off being in labour and her saying, it's not like that at all, you just get on with it. I thought, you know what, I'm in labour and this is the one time in my life when I'm going to be able to scream and nobody can give out to me. So I rejected Betty's values, screamed my head off. By the time I got to Hollis Street, I was completely hysterical. It was a huge mistake. 14 months later, going into labour again, this time I decide I will pursue Betty's path. I'm going to be completely calm. There will be no hysteria. I will just get on with it. Rang Hollis Street, said, you know, I'm getting a few pains. I'm sure it's not really labour. They said, all right, ring back in a little while when you know. In the meantime, Michael was out. He came home, finds me on the bathroom floor, looks down, sees a head coming towards him. And he ends up delivering the baby. And then I thought afterwards, OK, we went overboard there. Betty's way is just too much, right? You are actually allowed to say you're in labour and, you know, and you're sore and you actually need to get to hospital. So finally, third baby this time, waters broke, rang Mammy, think I'm in labour, no problem. She pulls her frozen shepherd's pie out of the freezer, cycles down the road on the bike. She's at the house. Michael and I are in the car into Hollis Street. pushed the baby out an hour later and everything was fine. No drama. A bit agricultural, but no drama. And oh, finally, I'm achieving the balance between being stoic and sensible and my own innate hysteria and doing things properly. So
was that terrifying to give birth on the floor of your bathroom?
For a while, I was in denial. I really thought it wasn't happening. And I think there was this brilliant moment of clarity, actually, when I realised, oh, I am about to give birth. And once I realised that, suddenly everything clicked and I actually knew what to do. Wait for a contraction, push then, relax in between, wait for the next one. And the great thing was, Michael was amazing because during the first birth, he had fainted, you know. And the midwives always said, normally what men do in that situation is one of two things. Either they run away to get help and leave the mother on her own, or they pick her up to try and get her to the car to bring her to hospital. Baby falls out or she gives birth in the car park. And he actually stayed with me and actually caught the baby. So they said he was amazing. And he is amazing. So
yeah, that's a
great story. Yeah, so that was that.
And Bill, you remember, don't you, driving. Is it over Rathmullein between Enfield and Trim when Sarah was being born? Do you remember that?
Yeah. I've never forgotten it. It was about 5 a.m. in the month of May, sunrise, and we're going over this hill, which is still there, and looking north, and the sun was coming up. And there was a mist rising in a valley and then the sunlight, and it was like a candy floss. And I thought it was the most spectacular scene either of us ever saw, looking across at it. So much so that we nearly wanted to stop the car to avail of it. And the next thing, you better get moving, you know. But that's what she came into the world she was born in a spectacular morning.
planets were all in alignment.
They were all in. But it's a scene I've never forgotten. And I cross, I go over, every time I go to Trim, I go over it, you know, and if it's a sunny day, looking across at Mead, there's a few hills over there. It's just absolutely beautiful. But I never can still see the candy floss misty thing rising and the sunlight above and below it.
You reminded me there of going over to Trim and being in Mead. All the archaeology of Mead, Newgrange and Nowth and Douth and Knock Crewe and all these things. My parents are almost cultish astro-astronomers and they're big into that archaeological heritage of Mead. So they'll go off on Midsummer's night over to the Druids in the Hill of Tara, walking up the Hill of Tara to see the sunrise. And I remember once meeting George Ogan, who's the professor of UCD who did the excavations of Nowth, and him saying that he always thought Daddy, who doesn't have a big formal education, he would have left school at about 14, that he was nearly the only councillor, one of the only councillors in County Meath who really appreciated Meath's archaeological heritage. So I went off with my mother there last year to Loch Crewe, where on the, what is it, the vernal equinox, and you see the sun shining into this tomb exactly like Newgrange, and all this incredible history that's there that they are really in awe of. And I think that probably sparked the big interest in history for me and why I ended up doing that in college.
Yeah, studying it in Trinity, didn't you?
Yeah.
Interestingly, in your childhood, Sarah, they didn't spoil you. Was it true like things? You were never given Easter eggs.
Oh, well, this was the other thing. I mean, we've talked about party politics, but there was a grander political scheme. And I always blame my Uncle Peter and Cavan for this. He had a phrase, capitalist society creating a need for the trash it produces. And this inspired this virulent anti-consumerism. And that things like Mother's Day and Father's Day and all these contrived festivals, that was just capitalist society, you know, trying to create a market to buy trash, rubbish it was. And one of the things was Easter eggs. This was just this completely makey-uppy thing. And I remember one Easter Sunday feeling so bitter about it. Daddy said, we did get you Easter eggs this Easter. And we were, oh yes. And he went off and he had this grin on his face and he came back into the kitchen holding Cadbury's cream eggs, you know, the little ones, and we got one each. And I was so mad. And it wasn't because I particularly wanted to gorge myself on cheap chocolate. It's because I knew I was going into school the next day and there'd be a girl in there waiting on me and she'd be there. How many did you get? I got 18. And I'd have to, what would I say? Would I say I had got two or three or something like that? And it always stuck with me as a thing about children. They want to be the same as all the other children.
Mm, that's so true.
But then they had other anti-capitalist slogans like, you'll never have in your pocket only what you earn yourself after a day's work. So any notion of going around quick schemes for making money and that, they're always doomed to failure. So while I always hated all this stuff when I was growing up, I didn't even know what capitalist society really was. I didn't care about it. I was 10. Now, when you look back, and you see the way things have worked out, you go, oh my God, they were right.
But do you buy your own children Easter eggs?
I buy my own children Easter eggs. We do the whole thing on Easter Sunday. And I remember about two Christmases ago, they started nagging for a PlayStation. And I agonised about this for weeks and weeks and weeks. And I remember finally cracking on Christmas Eve and saying, you know what? They can have one. And I bought a PlayStation and I gave it to them from Mammy and Daddy and said, here you go. Santi doesn't buy PlayStations, but you can have one from us. And that was another thing really as well, about all these slogans and people, dead relations and things, wisdom that they had that were always being pushed down our throats, you know. So another great one of Daddy's was, which also turned out to be true, if you had been at home learning your lessons and saying your prayers, that wouldn't have happened. So, you know, there was a lot of that folk wisdom.
What was she like as a little girl? I know you've name check all of your five children for me, first of all, Bill. There's Sarah. Who else is there in your family, your children?
Lizzie.
Well, start at the top.
Okay, start at the top.
The eldest is Kevin. He's an economist in the World Bank. Right. The second is Edward, who runs the family business. Then there's Sarah. Then there's Lizzie. Lizzie, as we speak, is working in Dublin in Focus. And the youngest is Mary, who is works in the housing section in Meath County Council. And when people talk about going into politics, like, I have more eggs in the basket than Sarah.
What was Sarah like as a little girl growing up?
Oh, she was always on the go, on a little tricycle and that sort of thing. Then when she went to school, the national school, a girl was the subject of laughing, timid little girl. And I think Sarah was in the class and she stood up and she said, I'm not laughing. And I told her I was delighted that she stood up for the weaker child, you know. Mm. And Betty told her the same thing. Well, then, after that, she went to the Kilcock. Then she went to Trinity.
I spent a lot of time in Trinity in all those debating societies, the Phil and the Hist and that. And I learned how to argue properly. So maybe that was the rock I perished.
Well, her mother would say she learned how to argue at home with her.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Mammy, you say I used to sit on the floor giving out to the washing machine, things like that. So that kicked in early, all of that.
But look, we're going to take another piece of music, which is one for your mum that she loves.
Oh, yeah, that's right. So this is Come Back, Paddy Riley, to Bally James Duff's the Percy French song. And it's not the best of Irish ballads, but on the trips up to Cavan when we were kids, we would always sing this on the way. And the whole Cavan thing is very important to us and all our relations up there. And her mother came from this parish called Mullaghorn, and the joke used to be at home that you'd think I was never a day out of Mullaghorn. So this is for all our friends and relations in Cavan.
The Garden of Eden has vanished, they say, but I know the lie of it still. Just turn to the left at Bridge of Finney, and stop when halfway to Coot Hill.
Come Home, Paddy Riley, to me, a song you both chose there for Betty, your mother and your wife, Bill. Sarah, you're a journalist now, but you weren't always a journalist, sure you weren't?
No, I had this whole corporate career. And I remember when I left college, I graduated in 92, I was completely unemployed for a year, did a postgrad in UCD, was still fishing around looking for something. It was very like then as it is now. And my very good friend, Tom McEnany, was a business journalist. And he told me about this new company, ESAT Telecom, and this guy, Dennis O'Brien. And he had gotten his first big break by writing a letter directly to Tony Ryan, And he said, Sarah, if you write a letter directly to Dennis O'Brien, he'll have to meet you. He'll have to give you a chance because he couldn't get in the door anywhere. So I remember sitting down at an old typewriter at home and writing this letter. And Dennis, if you want me on your team, give me a call. It was like completely brash American stuff. So he did give me a call. I went in, I met himself and Leslie Buckley, and they interviewed me for over 2 hours, really got to know me and basically offered me a job on the spot. And I started at the beginning of 1995, and that I was a real roller coaster year when they were building ESA Telecom and of course bidding for this famous license. And just the only funny thing was that within months of me starting, I proceeded to argue with the two of them for the whole year, and they used to be tearing their hair out over me. And the rows really all boiled down to me shouting at Dennis, you're not the boss of me, and him saying, yes I am actually, do what you're told. But I never would, and because I always disagreed with the way they were doing things. And I remember one day sitting on my desk looking up and seeing Leslie Buckley walking down the room towards me, and he didn't quite have his sleeves rolled up, but he had the air of a man who had just come out of a meeting and said, I'll deal with this one. And he sat down beside me and wanted me to explain the work that I was doing, and then he made helpful suggestions as to how I might improve my productivity and do things better their way. And I said, well, thank you very much for your suggestions, Leslie, but I'm actually quite happy the way I am. And he went off, and in due course I was summoned to Dennis's office, where I was informed that Leslie had declared me to be the most unmanageable employee he had ever come across. And this was supposed to be a reprimand. But in my head, I was thinking, ha, they think they can break me. They shall not break me. I will still be me. You know, it's a really perverse way of thinking. But Dennis, to his credit, and I think this is one of the reasons why he is a success, he said, look, she's a free spirit. She's an independent person, and we need to find her a job where she can feel independent but rise to a challenge. And he got me looking for the sites, for the masts, for the mobile phones. And it was brilliant because I was free. I was out and about in my car, up the side of mountains, talking to old farmers, talking to county councillors, for which I was obviously very well qualified to do, planners, and then appealing to my contrarian spirit, going to protest meetings with hundreds of people screaming at me, telling me I couldn't have a mast, which just made me all the more determined to get it. And that's where I met my husband Michael, because he had come home and he was put in charge. He was a construction engineer of actually building these masts. So so I got a husband out of the whole thing. So that was good.
So was that friendship or relationship with Dennis O'Brien, which has since then with the Moriarty Tribunal, got you into a lot of hot water?
Oh, I got myself into hot water, Miriam. When the whole tribunal thing kicked off, I leaked information that I thought was very important for people to know about. I leaked it to a journalist. And I remember one day then my solicitor ringing me. I was on a bus, and him saying, look, the tribunal want to know if you leaked this information. My grand plan had been I would not answer the question or find a way to, you know, avoid answering the question. He said, I have to reply to them. So I misled him about whether or not I'd leaked this information, because I was trying to conceal the fact that I was the source of the information. A few weeks later, he's back to me. The tribunal have said they're going to ask you about this when you're in the box under oath. And then I realised I had made a huge mistake. So I paid a price for that mistake. So it was actually nothing to do with Dennis O'Brien. Now, he is my... We're great friends, you know, and I have always kept up with him and that. But the trouble I got into, I did on my own.
What?
Go on, Bill.
There's just one thing. I don't want to keep going on about it, but the thing that annoys me about it is there was only one job lost. The lowest rung on the ladder was Sarah. Now, that annoys me.
That was from your Irish Times column, wasn't it, Sarah?
Yeah, that's right. I resigned from that. And it was all a huge shock at the time, because this all happened 8 or 9 years ago. And it was something that had been dealt with at the time openly, and I thought was over. So when the report came out, it just blew up. So it was a huge shock at the time. But then, you know, Mammy used to say at the time, everyone needs a setback, and you only learn things in life. And I always say my special gift in life is learning lessons the hard way. So since then, I have been really fortunate. I have my new baby. That put things in perspective. He was healthy, thank God. And my parents are healthy. Michael's parents are healthy. I still have my News Talk job. I started writing for the Irish Catholic, which is really interesting. They're a great audience. And, you know, I think I've put it behind me and learned, as usual, the hard way.
Because when you're in the eye of a storm or something like that, I mean, it was after the primetime programme you were on with me, really, wasn't it, that...
Yeah, that was awful because I had you were interviewing me, and the horrible thing about that was I was really nervous about it, and I was taking it all very seriously. And I remember just before the program started, I thought I was going to break down, and I went, "No, you are not going to break down on national TV. You are going to sit up straight and get through this with dignity." So I know that I said on the program that I shouldn't have done it, but my body language was saying the opposite. And so people thought I wasn't taking it seriously. So that was a problem.
To be fair, and this is against myself and our programme, you didn't have to come in that night.
No, I didn't. And I think people have often accused me of being blindly loyal to Dennis, and that I was going out and defending him just because we were friends. It's always been very hard for me because I was there helping on the bid and seeing how good it was, and also because I went down to the tribunal on several days and saw the evidence being given. So I was much closer to it than a lot of people were and knew an awful lot more about it. And there are, I think, two things that really damage this country. One is blind loyalty and people covering up for, say, the church or the banks or political parties. I've never done that. I've only ever shared what I thought was my honest opinion. But the other thing that's done it for this country is consensus. And I've always been afraid of consensus. And when everybody is saying the one thing, you need to look at the other side of things. And if I ever hid and didn't say something because I was afraid it wasn't popular, that's something I would never like to do. If I believe something, I think you have to stand up and say it.
I think a funny thing, her article in the Irish Catholic this week is worth reading because she asked the question in it a couple of times, with all the problems we have with abortion and all that sort of thing and the bondholders, what would Jesus do? WWJD. It's a slogan in America now. And what would Jesus do? And you see, she would was always thinking that way before she actually wrote it. And I think it's very sound philosophy. You know, if you are in a quandary like that, just step back and think, what would Jesus do? Now, you don't have to be a religious person.
Are you religious, Bill?
No. I'm a practicing Catholic. I rigidly go to Mass every week.
Rigidly doesn't sound that enjoyably.
No. Funny thing, but I hate missing the weekly Mass. You know, but I wouldn't call myself a religious person. I'd like to think I'd be a Christian person.
What about you, sir?
Yeah, I've joined them at Mass, and I go every Saturday now with them. And I'm like him now. I hate missing it. And it's 40 minutes where you can just sit down and take a breather from the week and an opportunity to reflect. Because I think we're all running around so much and you get so caught up in yourself and your own life and day-to-day stuff. And to sit back and hear the readings and the sermon and someone reminding you of the bigger picture, it's a really important exercise to actually do on a regular basis.
Do you think your faith grew, say, during the difficult times you had in the past couple of years? Not that they're fundamental to do with illness or children, but just, I suppose, even being in the public eye and being upset.
I think what happens is the older you get, the more you realise you're not on your own. I think when you're younger, you think, I'm great. I can do anything. Nobody's going to stop me. I don't need anybody else. But as you get older and you do have children, I think you realise how fragile everything is and that you actually do need help and guidance, moral guidance, you know, to get through life. And I love doing that as part of a community because I've dabbled in a bit of Buddhism and all that stuff myself, but doing it with your neighbours and everybody on the same journey, helping you through that journey, I think is really important. So Mass is now, I mean, it sounds ridiculous in some ways, it's one of the highlights of my week. I hate missing it.
And it's a Saturday night Mass,
isn't it? It's Saturday night. And I bring my son, who's had his first Holy Communion, with me. And it's really funny now. He'll notice if someone's not there because they're not in their seat. So he's into the routine now too. And there's the social aspect and getting to meet all your neighbours and your Mass friends. I've got my Mass friends.
But it's a good time because you could conceivably go out afterwards. In other words, it's 7 to 8.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It leaves a bit of the evening.
You can, but I don't. I don't go out afterwards. I go home and put the children to bed.
Mm. But you're also, as we close, still very into your vintage farm machinery. Tell me about this.
It's just, I got mildly interested in it a few years ago. I saw a fellow with a tractor that was like the last one we had, you know, back in the 40s, and I bought it. And then I realised, there was a bug to get back in. You know, your childhood days come. Mm. And then I bought a thrashing mill, which we used to have. I have a 90-year-old tractor that's still working. And when I hooked it up to the thrasher and the sound of the drum, you know, it's a whole
network. It's a whole cult thing, Miriam, this vintage farm machinery. And we laugh when we see Daddy at home, either on his computer, ordering parts from America for his restoration, or better, reading his tractor magazine, which we called his tractor porn, and drooling over spare parts that he could get. So maybe if he ever does retire from the council, he'll go into that full time.
Well, look, it's been my pleasure to have you both here this morning. We're going to end with a piece of music that you like, Sarah, Blur.
I saw a documentary one night about Blur and them singing this song, Tender, at the Glastonbury Festival in 2009. But the story behind it is they had all fallen out with each other in the early 2000s, completely broken up. It was so sad the way they weren't speaking to each other, these guys who had all been friends. And this was their comeback. And it was really emotional, singing this song back together and starting on another round in life. So when I hear this now, that's what I think of, a comeback and starting again.
I'm with you today. Of course, you have that beautiful baby, your 7-month-old David. He's a beautiful little baby.
He's a beautiful baby. Yeah. So we're starting again with him as well and trying to do right by him.
Your other two children are called?
They're called James and Tom. They're a little bit older, 7 and 8, and they adore their baby brother and are helping me rear him.
Okay, well, look, congratulations on your new baby. Best of luck for the future, Sarah, with everything you do. Bill, best of luck to you. I hope you stay in politics for the next 100 years. My thanks on sound today to Noel Roberts, to my producer, Eileen Herring. We're here at the same time next Sunday. We're going out now listening to Blur.
Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1. Listen back or podcast at rte.ie/radioplayer.